And this is Focus 580. It's our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Good morning, and welcome to this first hour of the show. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about Vietnam. And our guest is Neil Sheehan. He will be talking about a book that he has recently written about his experiences visiting Vietnam just recently in 1989. And it's a book about what Vietnam has been like in the post-war era and what people are thinking about as they think about their future. Neil Sheehan went first to Vietnam in 1962 to cover the war for United Press International. A little bit later, he went to work for the New York Times and also covered the war for the Times. In 1966, he went back to Washington and worked in the Washington Bureau of the Times, and there he served as Pentagon correspondent, White House correspondent, and also an investigative reporter, and in 1971 was the person who obtained the Pentagon Papers for the Times. An earlier book, A Bright Shining Lie, a book about the Vietnam War and the American experience there, won him the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award. He spent quite a number of years working on that book, and after that was finished, went back to Vietnam. And it is that visit on which the book that we'll be talking about this morning is based. And that book, by the way, is entitled After the War Was Over. It's published by Random House. And it is in two major sections, one about his visit to what was the North and the city of Hanoi, and then Saigon and the South. Neil Sheehan is joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, you should certainly feel free to call in if you have some comments or questions. We welcome you into the conversation. Mr. Sheehan, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, it's a pleasure to talk to you.
You explain in the book, right on the first page, I think, that when you were covering the war in the 60s, you told yourself that when the war was over and Vietnam was at peace that you wanted to go back. And it took a number of years, I guess in part because you spent most of those years writing Bright Shining Lie. But in 1989, you did get a chance to go back. What was it that made you want to go back?
I spent the most intense period of my life in Vietnam, three and a half years there as a journalist. And when you've done something like that, you naturally want to go back to the place where you spent those years. That was my youth. It was a war. It was an extremely, as I said, intense experience. And so I wanted to go back, and I wanted to see what had happened to the country. I love Vietnam. Most people who've spent a lot of time there do. I wanted to meet these people who resisted us so ferociously and who finally won their war. I wanted to look up some of the people who'd lost the war, Vietnamese on our side, some of them friends of mine, like Lee Tong Ba, who was a captain whom I knew in 1962 in the Delta, and who was captured as a general in by 1975, which he'd become, and spent 13 years in a re-education camp, almost 13 years. I tell his story in the book, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, you first landed in, first went to the northern part of the country and landed in Hanoi. And it was a place that when you were there during the war, you couldn't go because you and the other reporters who were covering the war in the south, everybody wanted to go to North Vietnam, but the government there wouldn't admit reporters who had worked in the south.
That's right.
So this was your first chance to go.
Yeah, right. That's right. And this was both a voyage of discovery and a voyage of remembrance for me. And the whole book is essentially about Vietnam today and Vietnam remembered. The North was a voyage of discovery in the sense that I had never been there and didn't know what to really expect. During the war, we thought of North Vietnam as this gray world of this Spartan people marshaled under this authoritarian system through win the war against first France, a superhuman effort, if you will, against France, and then the United States, when you think of the odds for the Vietnamese, who are a small people. But then I finally did get this chance to go, and we went first to the north, and when you land in Hanoi, you land in, it turns out, one of the poorest countries in the world. And you go into this grubby arrival shed at Hanoi Airport, Noi Bai Airport, and the customs in the place is gritty and the smells are bad. The customs officers are not well paid enough to even afford shoes. They're wearing rubber shower sandals and cast off military uniforms. And the first thought that hits you is, what in the name of God were we doing bombing a country as poor as this? And then you go into Hanoi itself, and it's like going into a museum, because in the central part of the city, there's been almost no new buildings since 1939, when World War II broke out, Indochina got isolated, and after that, the Vietnamese started fighting their wars for independence. And if you stand in this, in the old part of the city, if you stand in front of the, what is now the National Bank building, and used to be the Banque de l'Indochine in French days, and you blank out the picture of Ho Chi Minh, this big picture of Ho Chi Minh on top of it, you're standing in a French provincial, or French colonial capital of the 1920s and 30s. You're back in a kind of time capsule. And I start the book out that way by saying Hanoi is a city caught in the warp of time, because it is. It's a really unusual place. And that began this very unusual trip to the north.
Yeah. One of the first people that you met with in Hanoi was a man named Vo Nguyen Giap, who I suppose if anybody's going to be a living legend in Vietnam, it's going to be this guy, who was the commander of the victory over the French at Dien Bien Phu, and also was a close associate of Ho Chi Minh. Although he had fallen out with the leadership in the early 80s, more recently I think he's managed to climb back up somewhat, but probably not as high as his place in Vietnam's history would warrant. I think he must have made quite an impression on you, and as a sense, in a sense, perhaps representative of what people are thinking about as they try to think about the future of their country and where they would like to go.
Yes, General Giap is of course, probably after Ho Chi Minh, General Giap is the best known of the Vietnamese, because he was the victor of Dien Bien Phu, the commander of the Viet Minh forces against the French during the whole of the French War, and then was really the most influential general during the war against us as well. He's a fascinating man. He was 78 years old when I interviewed him in Hanoi, and I had thought it would be a formal interview, and had cranked up for that kind of thing, and had to submit some written questions in advance, which turned out to be just a formality. I intended to make them a formality anyway, and ask different questions, but when he came, he speaks very good French. He never intended to be a soldier. He was a lycée teacher. He taught history in a lycée in Hanoi. In fact, he taught the history of the French Revolution and Napoleon's campaigns before his anti-French activities forced him to head to the jungle, and then he began his military career as a resistance leader against the French. But he said to me, he started out the conversation by saying, "On va bavarder, we'll chat." And then he started to talk about his youth, about his boyhood, growing up in a family of provincial mandarins who had resisted the French, and the shame of losing your country as they had under the French, the years of growing up with this conflict in, between the French education he got when he was told that his own ancestry didn't mean anything, and his own feelings of nationalism. And I recount the interview in the book, but also one of the most, and that to me was, the interview turned out to be a really surprising one, and to me a much more interesting one than talking to this man about the few battles he's lost and the many he's won, which is what most interviews with him turn out to be. But one of the most surprising things about him and about all Vietnamese I ran into was their lack of animosity toward Americans, because late in this interview, he said to me, "You asked me if I had any animosity toward Americans." And this was one of the written questions I had submitted to him.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "How can I have animosity toward Americans as individuals? Major Thomas and I fought the Japanese together at Thai Nguyen." He was talking about an action during World War II when the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, which was the forerunner of the CIA, had supported the Viet Minh during World War II. They'd worked with us, rescued American pilots, and fought the Japanese. And he had fought a battle with the Japanese occupying forces at a place called Thai Nguyen, north of Hanoi, with an OSS group led by a major, Allison Kent Thomas, who's now retired in Michigan. And he said, "Major Thomas was my comrade in arms. How could I hate him? He's an American." In fact, not long after I saw Giap, a couple of years later, a year or so later, he and Major Thomas, who's now retired in Michigan, had a reunion together in Hanoi. Thomas went to Hanoi and met with Giap, and they had. But this turned out to be general. The Vietnamese have this surprising capacity to forgive their former enemies. I just didn't run into any animosity anywhere, and I thought I would.
Mm. And, you know, that's something that that I have read, a comment that I have read in accounts of other Americans who have gone back, some of them who were veterans, returning veterans. And I guess, you know, I've read it enough times now so that I have to believe it, and yet it still seems, as many times as I hear people say it, it still seems surprising.
It is surprising because it wouldn't be normal in this country. I think if a German had gone to some small town in Illinois in the 1950s, he would not have found he would have found some considerable resentment. I certainly think that would be true if he'd gone back to somewhere like France. But here we were in this country where the Vietnamese have every reason to hate us, given what we did to their country: a million dead during the war against the Americans, hundreds of thousands of missing in action. With in many cases no possibility whatsoever of finding out what happened to their loved one, or certainly no chance of recovering the remains. And here you arrive in this place, and you and these people don't hate. It turns out they don't hate Americans, and they just don't show animosity toward you. First, I was suspicious of it in Hanoi. That is, when we were talking to mainly government officials, because I thought, well, these people want good relations with the United States. Now they want to normalize relations with us, and so they're putting this, you know, this is policy. It'd be nice to Americans. And then I'll give you an example, which I give in after the war was over, which convinced me it was real. We were driving up to Lang Son, which is a town up on the China border, the Chinese wrecked during when they invaded Vietnam in 1979, because these wars went on for the Vietnamese. The Vietnamese were supposed to be the pawns of China, remember, and they were going to overrun all of Southeast Asia. It turned out to be the traditional enemies of the Chinese. One of the basic assumptions of the Vietnam War, which turned out to be another one of the fallacies and illusions upon which we based our intervention in Vietnam. But anyway, I was headed up to this place, and we got a flat tire in a village in the northern Red River Delta in the north. And we stopped to get it fixed. And I went through the village talking to people, and then I was standing out by the road with the guide interpreter I had talking to him. And this farmer came down the road on a bicycle, raggedy man, old, he looked old, white hair, most of his teeth gone, a rusty old bike. And he slammed the brakes on when he saw me. The Vietnamese don't see many foreigners in the countryside. He pointed his finger at me and he said, "Are you Russian, the insult?" And I shook my head, and I said, in one of the few words I have in Vietnamese, I said, "Me," which is American. And he said, "Thot, God," he smiled, snapped back in surprise. And he then said to me, and then the interpreter started to interpret, and he said, "Americans are good." I said, "Thank you very much." He said, "Vietnamese are good, too. Do you agree?" I said, "Yes, I agree." He said, "I'm a veteran. I fought in the South." I said, "Where did you fight?" I wanted to make sure he really was a veteran. I asked him where he'd fought. I asked him what unit he'd fought with. And it turned out he was telling the truth. He had the right details. And fighting in that area where he'd fought was particularly fierce in the rubber plantation country north of Saigon, and I said that to him. And he bent over, and he said, "Yes, so many bombs, so many shells, so much napalm. My hair turned like this," and he pointed to his white hair, and it turned out he wasn't that old. We had aged him, we Americans. Aged him prematurely. This is a man who'd really suffered at the hands of individual Americans. And he looked at me after this, and he put out his hand and shook mine. And as he shook my hand, he said, "Hoa Binh," which means peace in Vietnamese. And then he got on his bike and rode off down the road. And I realized then that this was genuine. And we ran into it again in this similar kind of circumstances, not quite as striking, but in the home of a family in a village who had lost a son in the South, and his portrait was on the wall before a small altar of honor. And they also showed no resentment toward us at all. And we weren't supposed to, these weren't people we were supposed to meet with. We had just encountered them. And so you realize it's real. It's part of Vietnamese culture. It apparently comes out of the long wars with China.
Our guest this morning is Neil Sheehan. He is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author. He won the Pulitzer for his book, A Bright Shining Lie, which is about the U.S. experience in Vietnam, and has a new book out that we're talking about based on his experiences going back to Vietnam in 1989 and seeing what things in the country were like and talking with people. This book, the newer book, is entitled After the War Was Over. And it's published by Random House. You should be able to find it in a bookstore or library if you want to look at it. And, of course, you can call in here this morning if you have questions, comments, want to be part of the conversation. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. When we talk about this war, I guess there is still the inclination to talk in terms of winners and losers. And generally, I guess, people would think that the Vietnamese won and the United States lost. But if you look at what conditions in the country have been like in the years since the war, it's hard to find something to point to say that, you know, there's evidence of a victory. The Vietnamese, the country is still in fairly bad shape. The infrastructure is in need of terrific rebuilding. And the Vietnamese really have had few people to turn to for help since right after the war they got no more U.S. aid, and they had a falling out with the Chinese as a result of the conflict over Cambodia, because the Chinese supported the Cambodians and the Vietnamese didn't. So then there was no more Chinese aid. When Vietnam went into Cambodia, the United States and China organized an economic boycott of Vietnam. So the Japanese and the Western Europeans stopped sending aid. Then to top it all off, in 91, the Soviets stopped sending aid. So pretty much the Vietnamese are out there almost completely by themselves.
The country is desperately poor. They won their war, but the sacrifice for their independence was so great that it really bled the country white. Jop said to me, our country's like a person who's been ill for a very long time. We're weak. We need to regain our strength again. And that's true. I mean, the country was simply bled by the incredible struggle for independence, which went on from 44, when the Viet Minh started during World War II and they began fighting the Japanese and the French. Colonial power, which the Japanese shortly before the war disarmed, but which remained in place until almost the end of World War II. And then the return of the French in 45, you start a 10-year war that lasts until Dien Bien Phu, after Dien Bien Phu in 54. And then you get the American War beginning in the early 60s. You get 30 years of war, really, for independence. And then the Vietnamese get caught up in this war with the Chinese pawn in Cambodia, this crazy man Pol Pot, who's still in power in the Thai border area of Cambodia, who was the leader of the Khmer Rouge, who not only murdered 700,000 to a million of his own people, but then who proceeded to start a border war with Vietnam, in which the Vietnamese lost tens of thousands of people. They finally, and the Chinese egged on Pol Pot, and the Vietnamese finally had to go into Cambodia to get rid of this man and call a halt to the war. I mean, imagine if what would happen to us if we had a government in Canada, which was shelling Detroit and all the border cities and launching raids into the cities, the area along the border, and was supported by the Soviets. Of course, we'd finally and they wouldn't stop it. We'd finally have to invade Canada to put an end to it. And that's what the Vietnamese had to do with Cambodia. And of course that dragged them into a long war in Cambodia in which they lost nearly as many killed as we did in the whole of the Vietnam War, when we lost almost 60,000 dead. They lost 55,000 killed in Cambodia. In the meantime, China invaded in the north in 79. They fought a war with China up there. It really has bled them white. But and then the economic embargo made things worse. So the country is desperately poor. But at the same time, they have begun to get their act together. They have begun to organize themselves. They are organizing themselves to try to recover once they get the opportunity to do so. Let me explain what I mean. You had an orthodox communist leadership in the period immediately after the war, which tried to build a socialist state. They were finally going to build a society in which there would be no want after all these years of struggle for independence. These are the original followers of Ho Chi Minh, who were, and they tried, and it was a total fiasco. It went broke because Marxism doesn't work. They would have had trouble anyway, but this made it worse. So in 1986, the Vietnamese simply abandoned communist economic models. Communism is just skin deep in Vietnam. It's something that the Vietnamese became communists as an accident of French domestic politics. Only the left supported independence for the colonies, and the Communist Party has always been essentially a nationalist party. So in 86, the reformers in the party got hold, and they abandoned communism, and they're trying to build, they have been since 86, long before it started in Eastern Europe, trying to build a free market economy. And they've made quite a bit of progress in that direction. It's still very fragile, but it's ameliorated conditions quite a bit.
This morning on our show, our guest is Neil Sheehan. He is the author of A Bright Shining Lie, a book about the American experience in Vietnam, which won both the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award. He covered Vietnam for United Press International and also for the New York Times, and is the author of a recent book, which is about his return to Vietnam in 1989. That book is entitled After the War Was Over, and it's published by Random House. Our number here is 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, anywhere you can hear us, 800-222-9455. We welcome your calls into our program. We do have someone here on our toll-free line, so we'll talk with them right now. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. I find this topic very interesting. I think we should recognize Vietnam. I think we should put the war behind us. But what worries me about this whole issue is the way the politicians have used the families of the POWs and the MIAs for their own political purposes. You hear Ronald Reagan and then after him George Bush get up, and they make speech number 11, where they say, we're not going to rest until all of them, and nothing changes. And I was wondering what your guests thought about this. I think it's tragic as it is, and I don't know whether we left Americans behind or not in Vietnam, but it's highly unlikely that any of these men are still alive. And what would you think of this, just declaring that it's done and put it behind us and simply declaring these men to be gone?
The POW-MIA controversy, I think, is going to be with us for a long, long time, because it's really something that grows out of the trauma of having lost the war in Vietnam. It's not just the physical loss of these men. It's the loss of the war itself and the psychological trauma that inflicted on this society, because we had far more missing in action in World War II.
Well, we had 78,000 missing out of World War II, did we not?
Right, and thousands missing in Korea, and nothing like this reaction. I don't think there are American prisoners alive in Vietnam now. I found no evidence of it. I think that I feel very badly for the families involved. I can understand their desire to get their loved ones back and their desire not to give up hope. However, what saddens me about it is I think that there's a terrible letdown ahead for them someday, because I think they've been taken advantage of.
Well, I agree with you. It's like I said, I think that Mr. Reagan and Mr. Bush have used them for their political purposes.
Everybody, a lot of people have. And some of them are well-intentioned, but misguided people, and others are doing it simply because there's actual profit in it for them, like these MIA professionals. They exist in Indochina as well as here, who've turned the thing to profit. There's a whole industry in Indochina of manufacturing phony evidence, like that photograph that showed up that had pictures of Russians on it, purported to be pictures of missing Americans. A few months ago, it was manufactured, it turned out, in Cambodia, in Phnom Penh. When you go to Vietnam, the first thing that you look at this country, you realize that, first of all, the Vietnamese would have no reason to keep American prisoners alive. What good would the prisoners do them? They can't trade them for anything anymore. That is, they can't get anything out of the United States for them. except the rewards, of course, which are very high. $1 million, I've heard kicked around, if someone could come up with a live American prisoner, which no one has.
Yeah, but that kind of money wouldn't help their economy.
Not in the long run, obviously.
Yeah.
The prisoners were valuable to the Vietnamese while they were trying to negotiate our exit from Vietnam, up to 1973 when they negotiated the Paris Accords. Up to that point, they wanted to hold on to prisoners. They got what they wanted, and I believe then they turned loose those who were in their control who were still alive. I'm talking about prisoners now. There were some deserters, I think, who stayed behind. I was told all of them had died. Garwood was one of them, Robert Garwood, the ex-Marine, who left of his own accord, came back to this country, was tried by the Marines, and put in for desertion. But the Vietnamese didn't force deserters to leave. Under the Vietnamese code, if you deserted, you had a right to sanctuary in their country. But prisoners, I think those they had that were alive in 73, were turned loose.
Well, now, if I'm not mistaken, North Vietnam and the Viet Cong had something like 200,000 or 300,000 people that they don't know what happened to, did they? Something.
Well, their own missing in action, as I said earlier in the program, run into hundreds of thousands. But and of course, no one here cares about that. You never hear about the suffering the Vietnamese have gone through, which in terms of the numbers is far greater than ours. And when I was in Hanoi, one of the people I interviewed, let me first finish this and then I'll go on to that. But the second thing that strikes you is, first of all, that this is a terribly poor country in which not even the most senior people have decent medical facilities. No hospital in Vietnam would pass certification in this country. Most veterinary hospitals in this country are cleaner in terms of sanitation than Vietnamese hospitals, because the Vietnamese can't even afford cleaning materials for the hospitals. So how would they keep these people alive for going on 20 years? Well, there's been one story recently that there was a secret prison underneath the Vietnamese Ministry for Defense. When we speak of a Ministry of Defense, we're talking about something like the Pentagon, which is this centrally air-conditioned building. The Vietnamese Ministry of Defense is a turn-of-the-century French compound in the middle of Hanoi. It's an old French military, sprawling old French military compound. The idea that they could build this elaborate prison in which they could keep people alive, which is very hard to do in that kind of a climate. And in those circumstances, Americans, for example, require a much more high caloric diet than Vietnamese. It's very unhealthy. The place is full of bugs. I'm talking about tuberculosis, basic diseases we got rid of in this country in the 19th century, like typhoid fever, Japanese encephalitis, which is endemic to that part of the world. I mean, it just is fantasy to think that they could keep people alive in captivity this long. And thirdly, I think if they did have American prisoners who were alive, we would know about it. We'd find out about it because the country's too open. Too many people are going through there. But you spoke earlier of the Vietnamese missing. And let me tell you, there's a group of mothers in Vietnam who lost so much. They're called Mothers of Martyrs. They're a special group of people, although they're not that uncommon. There are a lot of them because the Vietnamese suffered so much. I went to visit one lady in Hanoi, and I give an account of the talk with her in the book after the war was over. Her name was Mrs. Tin. She was 78 years old in 1989. She had lost four members of her family. She lost her husband in 1946. He was a doctor. He went into Hanoi to take care of the wounded when the fighting broke out with the French, and he disappeared. She was in the countryside with her children. She lost. She raised them there. Then one of two sons joined the army. She lost one son during the Battle of Dien Bien Phu. He died trying to defuse a bomb along one of the roads, the supply roads. She lost another son in the battle with the French after the war. So she lost three after Dien Bien Phu. Shortly afterwards, she lost this second son. So she lost three during the French War. Then when the American War came, her youngest son was drafted and sent to the South in 65. He was killed 3 years later in a battle not far north of Saigon. She has no way of recovering his remains because his whole unit was destroyed. She knows approximately when he died. She doesn't know the day he died. She knows the whole unit was destroyed in a battle. That's all she's able to find out. And yet she, again, like everyone else we ran into in Vietnam, didn't show any animosity toward us, which I found quite extraordinary.
Well, I just have one more comment, then I'll let someone else get on. I was going to mention that I'm surprised at the lack of animosity the Vietnamese have toward us. But I was curious to know, if this country is so poor, why didn't they sell some of the... I understand they got a tremendous amount of military equipment when Saigon fell, or when the South fell. Why didn't they sell some of that?
They still have it. The Vietnamese are one of the great repositories of used military equipment, and I'll tell you why I think they didn't sell it. First of all, I think the Vietnamese are very leery about getting involved in other people's wars. They are willing to give people psychological support in terms of what Radio Hanoi might say or in their foreign policy, but in terms of actually getting involved in other people's wars by giving them things, they're very leery of it. And secondly, they have always wanted to renew relations with this country. It has been a major goal for them since the end of the war. And they have not wanted to sell arms or give arms to any insurgent group and therefore offend the United States. They have billions, I'm talking literally billions of rounds of M16 ammunition. They have about 1 million M16 rifles. They have artillery pieces still in quite good working condition. They have tens of thousands of rounds of artillery ammunition. They used it in the war with the Chinese. They used the artillery in the war with the Chinese and in the war in Cambodia, American artillery. They've got armored personnel carriers. They've got now what are just hulks of airplanes, but they're waiting to sell this stuff legitimately to some British or American arms dealer so that they won't offend the United States. Unfortunately, it's gotten old in the process, and I'm afraid they could have gotten a lot of money for the stuff had they sold it originally. And they actually own it under international law. The South Vietnamese regime to which we'd given it surrendered unconditionally. So the Vietnamese own it under international law, but they have not sold it for those reasons. There's a major American dealer who would like to buy it now, I'm told, but the U.S. government has forbidden that firm to buy the stuff.
You said early in response to the caller's question that you thought it would be a long time before the MIA issue is resolved. Would it be possible to normalize relations between the U.S. and Vietnam before that is resolved, or must that be taken care of first?
I don't think that'll ever be resolved because I don't think there are a lot of people in this country who will never accept the fact that there are no American prisoners alive in Indochina. They simply won't accept it. They're too emotionally committed to the opposite point of view. It's almost like a cult in this country, the whole MIA thing. It is a cult, if you will. You see it everywhere. You see the MIA flag flown. It's flown over the Michael Dukakis, Bush's opponent in the last election. A decree that the MIA flag should fly, I think, one day a year over the State House in Boston and over state buildings throughout Massachusetts. You see it everywhere. It's almost become part of our culture, this belief that there are Americans still alive in Indochina. And I don't think that's going to go away. I do think there probably will be normalization of relations with Vietnam after this election, regardless of who wins, because it's this thing... Has the American embargo was always vengeance, and it's become much more apparent that it's vengeance in more recent years because there's no justification for it. There's a lot of pressure on the administration from some American businesses, particularly the oil companies who brought in the oil off Vietnam, and now the Vietnamese, because they couldn't sell the concessions back to the U.S. companies, the American government wouldn't let them deal with the Vietnamese. The Vietnamese have been forced to sell concessions because they're desperate for foreign currency. two other foreign companies, the Indian National Oil Companies in there, this Japanese group, the French National Oil Company, Total, is exploring for oil off Vietnam. And the Vietnamese are producing oil and selling it to the Japanese from two wells that Mobil brought in, from a field, really, in 1975. It's called the White Tiger Field. And Mobil hasn't been able to benefit from this, not because the Vietnamese want to keep them out, but because the U.S. government doesn't. So there's a lot. And there are farm machinery equipment companies like Caterpillar who have got pressure on the administration to lift this embargo and to normalize relations. And I think it'll happen next year.
We have about 10 minutes left. We have a couple of callers here we will take. Our guest this morning is Neil Sheehan, author of the book After the War Was Over, about his return visit in 1989 to Vietnam. His earlier book, A Bright Shining Lie, about the U.S. involvement in Vietnam, won him the Pulitzer Prize. If you have questions, you can call us. We do just have 10 minutes left, though, so we ask folks, if you can, to be as brief as you can. That way we can accommodate more callers. We'll go next to line one. Hello.
Politicians typically talk about the lessons of history and President Bush in conducting the Middle Eastern war referred to the lessons of Vietnam. What do you think the lessons are?
Well, there are a lot of lessons of Vietnam. One of them is to be very careful before you go to war because war is really the last resort. It's the ultimate act. And I think the Middle East war is an example of the fact that there has been hesitancy about going to war in this country. Reagan would have sent American troops into Nicaragua had it not been for Vietnam, which made that impossible. Even the senior military people were opposed to sending our troops into Nicaragua, and so he had to work through a surrogate group, the Contras, and it didn't work. But not because the American military realized that the U.S. troops would get bogged down in a long-term occupation of a country that would be probably pretty bloody. The war in the Middle East turned out to be not such a wise idea after all either. I, for one, think that the sanctions against Iraq would have worked if we had we had given them time to work. They were more than just sanctions. Iraq was under blockade after seizing Kuwait. Not that what Saddam Hussein did wasn't hideous and that he didn't trigger this whole thing, but George Bush wanted to go to war against Iraq from day one and did, and the war turned out to be wonderful victory we were told it would be. Afterwards, it was a very messy business. Remember, he told us there would be no more Vietnam, that Iraq would not be another Vietnam. There would be a nice, clean ending to this war. Well, the Kurds rose, and they were allowed to be slaughtered. I remember noticing a calculation by the American Agency for International Development that 6,500 Kurdish children had died of exposure and a disease on those mountainsides when the Kurds were fleeing. The Shiites in the south were slaughtered. Now they're finally being given some protection. There's an election coming. Perhaps they hope that there'll be another war to distract attention from it. But right after the war, when they were encouraged to rise and were slaughtered by Saddam Hussein, nothing was done. The man's still in power. I mean, he's still there. This man we were told was Hitler. Do you call a truce with Hitler? Do you work out agreements with Hitler? It doesn't make any. It didn't make any sense. So I don't think we've absorbed some of the lessons, and that there is hesitancy among a lot of people about going to war for the wrong reasons, or going to war in a situation where you don't really know what you're doing. I think we've got a long way to go before we learn that in other lessons. The basic lesson is that, you know, we're human like the rest of the human race. We're not exceptions to history.
Well, you sound a little bit Clausewitzian, that war is the extreme example of diplomacy.
I don't mean the extreme example of diplomacy. I mean the ultimate act. It's an act of violence, of extreme violence, which causes harm, not only to your potential harm to your own people. In the case of the Gulf, of course, our people didn't get hurt, but we did kill tens of thousands of Iraqis. We got thousands and probably tens of thousands of Shiites and Kurds killed. To what end was this? Okay. Was it worth it? That's what I'm talking about. War is that is unleashing the ultimate, and you should hesitate very carefully before you do, because one of the, another of those lessons you're talking about of Vietnam is that we Americans are also part of the human race, and the human race can do evil as easily as it can do good. There is no progress in the morality of humankind. It doesn't occur. It hasn't occurred. There's been physical and scientific progress, but there hasn't been moral. Look at Yugoslavia. This is happening in Europe, and it's hideous. So one ought to learn that we too are human.
In the Nixonian conduct of the war, trying to win peace by constantly by using a step up in the amount of force to try to bring the North Vietnamese to the table. It seems to me that another lesson may be that. That Clausewitzian theory isn't correct. That war isn't a very good instrument of diplomacy.
Well, sometimes you have to fight to defend yourself. If you don't have any, the Vietnamese had that choice. I mean, they had to fight us because the only way to get us out of their country and to win their independence was to resist us. They were willing to resist us no matter what it costs. I mentioned this woman, Mrs. Tin, who lost four people whom I interviewed in the North and whose story I recount in the book After the War Was Over, this most recent book. One of the things that came out in the conversation with her was that while she was terribly saddened at losing three sons and a husband, she accepted this as being necessary for the independence of the country. In a strange way, she was proud of the sacrifice of her family. She showed us photographs not only of them, but of herself with the four decorations she'd received for the four men in her family whom she lost, and she was proud of them and proud of the fact that her family would sacrifice this much for the country. So Nixon thought he could frighten the Vietnamese with the B-52s. That battle with the B-52s in their perspective I also give, the Christmas bombing, in the book. It's quite unique. I mean, they regard themselves as having won the battle of the B-52s. Of course, they didn't. They didn't defeat the B-52s. But to them, a small a country like that, I mean, the B-52s was the ultimate. It was like the Death Star. Like the Death Stars in the Darth Vader machine, and they survived it. And then they got us out of the country shortly afterwards. So that to them, it was a victory. And they're not people who could be frightened because they were willing to make the ultimate sacrifice.
We got one more caller here, our toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning. I noticed on a documentary that was on TV a while ago that the VCs seem to have similar forgiveness attitudes as you say the North had, but it seemed to me they went beyond that as they were proud, almost bragging about, one woman was saying South Vietnamese was electrocuting her nipples while the Americans watched, and she was very proud that she didn't give up her village, and she seemed to expect that that we would forgive her, whereas I still hold a special hate. I was too young to go to Vietnam, but I still hold a special hate for the VC, you know, far beyond the North. And I'm wondering, have you talked to the VC and gotten similar attitudes and perhaps facts?
I talked to people in Vietnam who fought with the Viet Cong. The VC you're talking about are the communist-led guerrillas in the South. The Southerners who were not in the regular Vietnamese army who resisted us through the Viet Cong. Obviously, people are going to, in any society, they're going to draw pride from having resisted successfully a foreigner in what they regard as a war for independence, and I think you've got to look at it that way if you're going to understand their point of view. Hating them won't help them or us. Hate is, to me, is a destructive emotion. The war is over now. It's time to make peace, they think. I think that I kept asking why, where this comes from, and I'm told it comes out of the wars with China. The Vietnamese have had these repeated wars with China over the years to maintain their independence. And after the war, you make peace. It's been a basic thing that's become part of their culture. And one Vietnamese said to me, the Chinese are too big. You can't remain enemies with China forever. The country's it's just too big. It's a huge empire. I mean, Vietnam is reaching out to this country. The Vietnamese are trying to create a free market economy, which is something we're supposed to be supporting. We claim we're a capitalist society. We're in favor of spreading capitalism. You listen to somebody who's been a Vietnamese Communist Party member all his adult life, and he tells you what a wonderful economist Milton Friedman is. Milton Friedman's the radical American free market economist. I mean, if it were happening anywhere else, we would be giving this kind of thing some support. But ironically, because of the Vietnamese are doing it, and they happen to defeat us in a war, we still hold great resentment toward them and won't help them. I think this is an erroneous and a sad attitude.
Well, we will have to leave it at that because we have come to the end of the time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For talking with us.
You're welcome.
Our guest, Neil Sheehan. And if you would like to read his new book, it is entitled After the War Was Over, Hanoi and Saigon, about his return to Vietnam in 1989. It's published by Random House. His earlier book, which won both the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award, A History of the U.S. Involvement in Vietnam, is entitled A Bright Shining Lie.